Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigh. It's so nice to have all of you with us for a show. Not much to talk about today, is there? No big news in the Georgia governor's race. No big news out of the Trump White House. We don't have anything to talk about, but we'll figure out something to do. Before I introduce the panel and we get started, a couple of quick notes. First of all, you can, of course, watch us on Facebook Live. Right now, just go to the GPB News page on Facebook, and you'll find us there. Leave comments. We love to hear from you. If you prefer to tweet, tweet us at PoliticsGPB and join the conversation that way. Also, of course, next week, we start our four-day-a-week schedule. We'll be on the air Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. We add Tuesday to the schedule. And, of course, we're on at 2 o'clock on all of those days live. If you're out at WUGA, our good friends at WUGA, we are so happy that you carry us. You are with us every Friday on the air. And if you listen from WUGA, you can subscribe to the Political Rewind podcast and hear all of our shows that way. All right, let's get going. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. You read him in the Wednesday and Sunday paper. You've got a great column coming up Sunday that's going to be a blueprint for some of our conversation today. And you oversee the Political Insider blog at myajc.com.
Yeah, this has just been such a dull runoff, hasn't it?
Loretta Lepore, a Republican strategist. She was press secretary to former Governor Sonny Perdue, now our agriculture secretary. And someone whose fingerprints we may see in the Donald Trump endorsement of Brian Kemp. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes, Loretta.
Okay, great to be here.
Good to have you here. Michael Owens, Democratic chair of the chairman of the Democratic Party of Cobb County. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, as always.
And Republican Ed Lindsay, former Republican member of the state legislature from Brookhaven, right? Brookhaven.
That's correct.
When did you finally get out of the legislature, Ed?
2014.
Okay. And now an attorney partner at Denton's and the head of their Georgia government affairs practice, right?
That's correct.
All right. Jim Galloway, let's get started. You have in your column, your Sunday column has this lead.
Yeah, just posted it.
Just posted it at Political Insider at myajc.com. The GOP runoff for governor is no longer a contest twixt Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp. It's become a tug of war featuring the two most popular Republicans in the state of Georgia, Governor Nathan Deal and President Donald Trump, who have placed themselves on opposite sides of Tuesday's finale. So let's dig in. First of all, what the heck is President Trump doing jumping into a Republican runoff?
This is the question of the week, because that's it, look. It was Casey Cagle was struggling a bit in previous weeks, thanks to that secret recording that we've talked about quite a bit here, and so it wasn't really that much of a surprise when Nathan Deal endorsed him on Monday. That was kind of expected. What was unexpected is that 48 hours later, Donald Trump would jump in on the opposite side and endorse Brian Kemp. He had made no other noises about the judicial contest, the gubernatorial contest. Both Kemp and Cagle were kind of equal in their pledges of fealty to the president, so that there wasn't any air between them on that score. And yet he jumped in to the race.
Loretta, the tweet reads this way. Brian is tough on crime, strong on the border and illegal immigration. He loves our military and our vets and protects our Second Amendment. I give him my full and total endorsement. Did your jaw drop when you saw that?
Well, my jaw didn't drop. It was a little surprising that the president decided to just jump in without any indication. I don't know that the Kemp campaign was fully anticipating that. So I know that there were conversations occurring with folks in Washington of varying degrees. not necessarily the president, though. So I think it came as a surprise to most people.
Well, apparently it came as a complete shock to the Kemp people. They're reporting that your colleagues at the AJC have is that Kemp was in the middle of an event when he saw that his aides were jumping up and down with their cell phones, and he knew something had happened.
Yeah, he was one of the last to know.
Yeah. Michael.
You know, I remember the last time I was on Political Rewind, we were talking about if Trump would and what would it take for him to jump in. And I remember two things that I mentioned. One was it would be a surprise to everyone because Trump's going to do it just because he feels like doing it one day. And the second was, that he would like to see some momentum going one way because he wants to choose a winner. And the second thing would be that if there was something that happened in the media that he happened to catch and he really liked for either candidate, that would sway his vote. So, you know, I want to make note of an article that was in New York Times about, and this kind of hits home here, I think it's House District 50, House District 29, Maria Palacios, who was running for office up there. She's a DACA recipient,
right? Yeah.
And so she actually was not successful in that. It just came down this past week, and Trump was one of the people who actually said, no, you cannot do this. It's not legal.
Kemp was.
Right? And it hit the New York Times, and it was obviously a story in New York Times, a very well-written piece, a long piece. And, you know, I wonder, you know, if this had anything to do with it, as far as Trump looking at this and going, Kemp is strong. He's strong on the border. He's strong on these issues. Let's choose this guy. I don't know, but the way that ties in was exactly something I would said would be the type of article or type of news that would make Trump take a stance.
Well, keep in mind, we have to remember, looking back now, you kind of ask yourself, why are we all so surprised? Because the Trump administration has a lot of Georgians who are awfully close to the president. We've got Senator David Perdue. We've got Secretary Sonny Perdue. We've got Newt Gingrich. We've got Nick Ayers. We've got Stephen Passantino, who's in his legal office. So he's got surrounding him a lot of Georgians who would obviously be interested in this race and would be talking to him one way or the other. So, you know, looking back, I don't know why we were that surprised.
You've left out one name, Ralph Reed.
And Ralph Reed, I did. And thank you. He was on my list, but I did leave him out. But Ralph would be another person who would be likely to be weighing in. And keep in mind that within 2 days, we now have Vice President Pence coming down, which kind of tells you that probably something was in the works for a little bit longer, because usually to get a president or even a vice president to come into a place, it takes a little bit of groundwork, more than a day or two. So my guess is that perhaps Kemp campaign was surprised as to the timing, but my guess is that there had to be something that was going on in the works.
All right. Loretta, I still ask the question, why would the president want to make a choice in a Republican primary? Now, I get, you know, Nathan Deal, we think we know, Jim, I think from the reporting you all have done, Nathan Deal jumped in on behalf of Cagle. It appears rather reluctantly. He didn't seem to want to really get into this race. The endorsement that he gave at the Capitol was fascinating because it came at the end of a lot of other things that he did. It seemed to be something that he felt he had to do because he thought Cagle was a better inheritor than Kemp. But it was a reluctant endorsement. Trump had no reason to. I mean, Trump just jumps in. So I ask again, I understand what Ed's saying, and you know, too, how many Georgians are around the president. Why?
Well,
What does he gain?
Well, I think somewhat to Ed's point that there was probably an echo chamber growing to some extent by those Georgians who are in Washington. You know, one of the Georgians that was not mentioned is Paul Beneke, who runs the Republican Governors Association.
Very good.
And Paul was also an advisor to Secretary Perdue, tied in very closely with Nick Ayers. They were at the RGA together at one point in time. And there are about 36 state gubernatorial races, I believe, up this year. And so there's somewhat of an urgency, too, to get some nominees, get some momentum. So those candidates that are beginning to show momentum, to maybe come behind them and push that momentum so they can get onto the business of getting these folks elected, because what happens at the state level impacts what happens at the congressional level, and then ultimately in 2020. And so there's some relationship building going on here. But I think all of the folks that are, you know, a lot of these folks, I know that that Senator Perdue and Secretary Perdue have both indicated that they were staying neutral in this. But some of the others, like Newt Gingrich, did not. And he's been close to the president in the last couple of days simply because of the Russia discussion. And he was vocal on that and speaking to the president. So, you know, there's no telling at what point the president said, look, I'm hearing a lot and I'm going to get in this. It is different than what happened in South Carolina, where Governor McMaster actively campaigned during the last election cycle for the president, and he had a reason to jump back in there to support the person who helped him get elected and carry a state that was critical.
Yep.
So that's the difference here.
Yeah, I think one thing we need to consider is the fact that we see a reassertion of influence among the Perdue clan, the cousins, in middle Georgia, in all of this. Sonny was at that cabinet meeting on Wednesday. Nick Garris was in that same room. It adjourned at 12:22. The Trump tweet went out at 3:25. There's a little bit of timing that's interesting there. But I think you have to also consider, as Loretta said, the Paul Beneke connection, the Nick Garris connection, and don't forget that the new chairman of the state GOP is John Watson, who was once Sonny Perdue's chief of staff.
Yeah, let's just clarify some of these names. I know many of you are already with us on this, but Nick Ayers, of course, he started his political ascendancy working on the Sonny Perdue gubernatorial race.
Just a driver. Yeah.
But he began there. He quickly went to Washington and moved up through the ranks. He is now Vice President Pence's chief of staff and apparently quite a force, Nick has been in every job he's had. So we just want to clarify who Nick is in this equation. And you know, it's funny. And then I want to give Ed and Michael a chance to jump in. Mike Thurman, the Democratic chair of the CEO of DeKalb County, has on this show a number of times said, well, you know, Sonny and David Perdue, the cousins, they're going to make endorsements in this race pretty soon. We'll see who they. And I kept saying, Michael, there's no reason in the world why they would. Well, it turns out Michael was more right than I am, because they did it by getting to the president, is the speculation.
Well, there's a lot of speculation, and we've now gone through a pretty big laundry list of possible folks who got a hold of the president's ear on this one. But the bottom line is that he did endorse, and not just through a tweet, but he's bringing down his vice president, who is coming into town to campaign on behalf of Secretary Kemp. And you know, and that's going to be a big event, and that's going to be a big push for Brian Kemp in the closing days of the campaign.
You know, I was just going to say from a pure Democratic standpoint, for Democratic Party, I think it's important for them to get for President Trump to get involved in it, because the Democrats are surging. And, you know, as Stacey Abrams continues to build momentum, I think this race becomes on a national stage. And they want to get involved and get in early and ensure that this momentum that Stacey Abrams comes is tampered down a little bit. Stacey Abrams has proven to be a national candidate on a national stage, and I can look for more national endorsements for her. So getting a Trump endorsement in there, even while they're still in the midst of the primary, I think is going to help with that. I mean, just last night, I mean, we had Cory Booker was in town, the former
Tom Perez was.
Eric Holder was. So, you know, this was at a gala and a national Black African American summit that was held here in Atlanta. So the Democratic Party is really starting to flex their muscles a little bit with national level prominence coming in. So that may have had a little bit to do with it as well.
Yeah, what you're seeing here, Bill, is kind of the nationalization of in very short order of the Georgia
of the
entire race.
Yeah,
yes.
But I still have my doubts as to whether it will ultimately be. It'll be nationalized in terms of money coming in.
Money and media.
Money and media comes in, yes. But at the end of the day, unlike senators and congressmen who go to Washington, governors deal with local issues. They deal with getting the roads paved, getting the children educated, getting economic development into your community. And those, I think, will ultimately be the issues that are going to determine that governor's race. Granted, and on both sides, you're going to be getting money coming in and attention coming in nationally. And Stacey Abrams in particular has tried to cultivate that in order to boost her candidacy. But at the end of the day, guys, it's going to be a local issue.
All right, let's okay, there's still so much more to unpack on this. Loretta, let's start with you. Nathan, Jim framed it correctly. Mm-hmm. This is now Nathan Deal, in some ways, versus Donald Trump in terms of influence over Republican runoff voters, at the very least, which is a smaller number of voters than we would expect to see in other election contests. So how much does it matter in terms of the outcome of this race right now that Trump has endorsed Kemp? As Jim pointed out earlier, I use my words different from his in saying that both Kemp and Cagle have vied to be the Trumpiest in this race, and now Kemp wins that crown.
Well, I think where the president's endorsement helps is that the base is very much energized by the president. And so in this respect, those people or those individual voters who were already in Team Kemp are going to be that much more energized to get out and continue the work of getting the vote out, because that's what this race is going to come down to, who votes. I think to Jim's point in his article on with the governor, I don't know that this is so much of a – I don't really see this as the governor versus the president. I see this now as two candidates trying to make different cases, right? So you've seen Casey – Cagle kind of pivot a little bit now as to say it's now about the legacy that the governor and I have worked on together around boosting this economy, keeping Georgia a vibrant place to live, work, and play. And so he's got to go out and push that message, and that's what the governor gives him, is a successful track record. And what the president gives is energy to that base that's behind Brian Kemp.
What I think you got to keep in mind, it's not so much the governor versus Trump as it is Trump versus the negative advertising by Cagle. And Cagle has gone really hard negative. And hard negative, particularly with a low turnout situation, isn't so much designed to get people to come vote for you as it is oftentimes simply to try to depress the voter turnout for your opponent. That's how generally negative advertising works, particularly in a low turnout situation. And what Trump does here is he energizes the Kemp people to go, okay, you can put aside, you don't like Cagle, you can put aside any questions you may have had by Kemp as a result of this terribly negative campaign that Cagle's now waging. And trust me, I put my seal of approval on this man. Go out and vote for him. That, I think, is where it's so effective here.
Michael, how does Casey Cagle fight back? Will, we can talk in a moment about what he is doing, but I mean, but you're a chairman of a party. You know, you're the kind of person who gets involved in strategizing on issues like this. How would you fight back?
Yeah, I think he's going back to what Ed said and make this about a very local race. Make this about Georgia. Make this about Georgians. And talk up, you know, what he's done as lieutenant governor and his ties to Nathan Deal, and really harp on that. Really, really, really talk about the accolades. And look, if you go negative, I think, you know, the issues he's had around the data privacy and those type issues was already came out, I think are things that will work better than just a pure negative ads on he owes money or some of the other things. So it's a tough road. There's no doubt about it.
Jim, in your last poll, 21% of Republican voters who say they're going to vote in the runoff say they are voting for this candidate they believe is the strongest in supporting Donald Trump.
Right. Now, so the question is, can Brian Kemp get that message out? And of course, he's got Donald Trump's megaphone right now, his Twitter account.
Well, why don't we? Can I interrupt you and then let you start? Here's one way he can get it out. How about this new TV spot they've put together very quickly?
President Trump has made his choice. Brian Kemp for governor. Trump says Brian is, quote, tough on crime, strong on borders, and protects our Second Amendment. Trump gives his full endorsement to Brian Kemp for Georgia.
I'm Brian Kemp. I strongly support President Trump, our troops, and ironclad borders. If you're ready for a politically incorrect conservative, I'm Brian Kemp, and I'm asking for your vote.
Brian Kemp, the only Trump-endorsed candidate for governor.
Go ahead, Mr. Galloway.
Okay, that's a celebratory tone that says it's all over.
Is it?
I mean, that's what Kemp would have you believe here. The question is, how much money is he putting behind that ad?
That's right.
Casey still has an advantage in money. And remember, this endorsement came 3 days on the with only 3 days of early voting left. And there, quite a few ballots have already been cast, and so if you're on the Cagle campaign, you're wondering, did you do your job on that portion of the campaign?
Cagle, Loretta and Ed has a tough road to hoe here, though. He's been running as a friend of the president's, and he's again tried to make sure people see him as the strongest supporter of the two of them in the race. So he can't now suddenly turn and attack the president, but he's done something rather odd. He's focusing his wrath on Clay Tippins, the former opponent of his who made the secret recording that probably put Casey in a position where he was really vulnerable in this runoff. I don't know how that translates to votes.
Well, I think to the first part of that, you know, we've seen the response from the Cagle campaign being such that, you know, no hard feelings with the president. We know he'll get behind us in the general election. So once we win, hopefully he'll be with us then. I think the thing with Clay Tippins was probably, you know, some staffers that got a little bit out there. There's clearly no goodwill between the Cagle camp and Clay Tippins. But that's kind of just a side note. That's something that's just off to the side at this point.
One of the two messages that Cagle was very quick out of the box on yesterday, the day after Trump's endorsement of Kemp, were on two points. He was emphasizing his electability against Stacey Abrams in November, and he was kind of throwing shade at Washington Republicans who had misled the president, which you know, it's I'm not sure how effective it is, but it's something of an answer there.
That theme is going to get hurt when the vice president comes down.
Right, right.
I think what they were hoping on was this was going to be a tweet and it wasn't going to be anything else. But once the vice president comes down, then it got to be an additional problem for him. And it undercut that theme again. And when it comes to Clay Tippins, well, this is what I've heard from folks. I don't like what Clay did, and I don't like what Cagle said. So this is one of these situations where you don't have to choose between the two. You can both dislike the fact, yes, that someone surreptitiously recorded someone else, and you really don't like what the lieutenant governor said. And that's the problem that Cagle's in. And that's the problem. Every time he raises Tippins, it reminds people of
the what, he said. What he said.
All right, let's do this. We got a lot more to unpack as we head toward that runoff election, which is just really 4 days away. But let's get a break in right now. Come back and talk more about the Cagle-Kemp race in light of the endorsement by President Trump, and talk about why, in the long run, Michael Owens, you're feeling encouraged that Donald Trump has injected himself in this race. We'll ask why. But we'll go to this break first.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive away. Drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Michael Owens, Ed Lindsay, Loretta Lepore, Jim Galloway in the studio today. We've been getting a lot of comments, especially on our Facebook Live page. So let me just tell you in general, rather than try to read each of them. There are any number of people who think that Brian Kemp, and Michael, this is one for you, I guess. Brian Kemp is going to end up in the general, if he's the candidate. There are people here suggesting you can't let the Secretary of State, oversee an election, especially given the issues that we've had with security of election data, release of some of that data, the breaches of the system up at Kennesaw State University. So there are people who are seeing that as an issue that Brian Kemp's going to have to contend with if he becomes the nominee.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously going to be a point, I think, from a general election where if Brian Kemp does wind up being a nominee, I think that's an issue that cuts across party lines because it wasn't just Democratic voters whose data was exposed. So this is an issue that everyone, I think, can understand inherent danger of it. You know, if it's from him overseeing an election, there's going to continue to be issues with that. I mean, we've from a Democratic side and both a nonpartisan side, I know there's been pushes to try to deal with that, no pun intended, but really to look at what's happening there and even goes to the matter of purging voters, right, and the whole voter list. I think this past weekend there was over 500,000 voters that was wiped off the rolls.
No, that was that post was from 2017. I checked the date.
Okay,
on it.
Yeah. Good. Okay.
But it's interesting because this was not an issue in 2006 when Secretary of State Kathy Cox was running for governor. She was defeated in the primary by
Mark Taylor. Nor in 1996 when our U.S. former U.S. senator was running.
Max Cleland
was running.
Right. The difference, of course, is that now we've got the issue of Russian hacking into U.S. voting systems.
Yeah.
And that changes, I think, the dynamic a little bit, at least.
Yeah, we actually have a message on Facebook from Laura Adams, who's watching. She says, endorsing Kemp endorses the guy in charge of the 2016 voting machines possibly compromised by Russia. Now, we really don't have any reason to believe. We do know that in the reporting of the indictments of the 12 Russians, that the special counsel's report does say that there were at least two counties in Georgia where there was apparently an attempt to penetrate the voting systems. Laura takes it a little further than we know to be true at this point.
Keep in mind, President Obama's administration were basically tamping down on this kind of speculative talk in 2016 when certain supporters of the Trump team were advancing that they were going to question the outcome. So, I see a strong partisan hand here that doesn't necessarily fit with any kind of facts that have come out so far.
So, the secret tape seems to have been the moment that changed everything for Casey Cagle. We knew that in a runoff election, anything can happen anyway, right? I mean, runoffs are notoriously dangerous for candidates who could have almost gotten over the top without the runoff. But if the secret recording changed everything, Loretta, does Casey Cagle have no one but himself to blame for whatever reason he spoke out as he did with Clay Tippins?
Okay. Well, I think there are two things that changed the game here. So I think in the primary election, Brian put himself on the map with his campaign ad, right? He was a sleeper in the race. Hunter Hill, Clay Tippins were picking up some steam. And then he launches this ad campaign that gains national media attention, kind of catapults him within the state. He comes out at a much higher level within the runoff than anybody thought he would in winning the primary. So I think that was first. And then you couple that with the recording. And I think the operative words in the recording were politics over policy, which the Kemp campaign has been able to use to affect. So I have to give the Kemp campaign some credit for using it to effect. And I think the Cagle campaign has struggled with how to come out of that.
They've tried.
And keep in mind that the Cagle campaign was already struggling coming out of the primary because they had underperformed in that primary.
Right.
They, you know, I think they were up around 40-45% according to the polls in November 2017, January 2018, and then they came in at what, 39%.
Yeah.
So they, I mean, there was already, if not blood in the water, at least some wounds that were already inflicted that Kemp's campaign could go into, because Cagle's strength all the way through this has been, I'm the front runner. I'm the only one you should be giving money to. I'm the only one you should be supporting because I'm the front runner. And once that got weakened at coming out of the primary, you know, he was suddenly vulnerable.
All right,
well, I think the other move that was very, very important in this that happened even a little bit before the tape came out was that the Hunter Hill people, the people that were working on that campaign, all moved over to Brian Kemp in rapid speed. I mean, there was little daylight once the primary was over, where most of Hunter's team moved over. So that began a certain level of momentum, particularly in rallying the base of where do we go.
All right, so let's pivot. First of all, before we do, we still think we have a horse race on our hands here, Jim Galloway. I mean, we don't want to jump to the conclusion. I mean, the momentum seems to be in Kemp's favor, but come on. We don't have any reason to believe this isn't still a horse race, do we?
It's a contest that I would not call.
You don't want to bet on this outcome point, right?
No,
I agree.
No, absolutely not. 4 days is a lifetime in elections. Kemp has now made it competitive, but keep in mind, Cagle, with the help of $10 million, has built a good infrastructure around the state. And when you have a low turnout situation, it's all about getting your people out. And he's got a good phone base and everything else.
All right. Thank you for that. Because now let's pivot to what we think the outcome might mean for the general election. You know, for the last couple of weeks, I have struggled on the air just kind of talking spontaneously. I keep describing Kemp as like an outsider. Well, he's not an outsider. He's been in state government forever. What I really should have been saying is that he's played the role of disruptor in this campaign. And I think one way to illustrate that is to listen to the audio of the TV spot that the campaign intended to be their closing campaign spot until they got the endorsement from Trump. And I think it tells us a lot about what what Brian Kemp did to get to where he is, because Loretta talked about it, and what maybe Democrats are going to contend with moving forward.
I'm Brian Kemp. I believe in God, family, and country in that order. I say Merry Christmas and God bless you. I strongly support President Trump, our troops, and ironclad borders, and I stand for our national anthem. If any of this offends you, then I'm not your guy. But if you're ready for a politically incorrect conservative who will end corrupt pay-to-play politics, I'm Brian Kemp, and I'm asking for your vote.
And yeah, Michael, I just said that.
Yeah, this is what I feel, regardless whether it's Kemp or Cagle comes out of this primary runoff, they're going to go to. They're going to go strictly to the Trump base. They're going to talk borders. They're going to talk immigration. And they're really going to key in on those things that they really feel appeal to the Trump base. You know, I was reading an article, I think we may have shared it earlier today, but talks about where Trump, how solidified Trump voters are to supporting him, whether, you know, the vast majority of Americans think he's right or wrong. Those people that are true to the Trump campaign and Trump doctrine, if you will, they're going to stick with them no matter what. So I think it's going to be no doubt where this race is going to go to down the general. They're going to, you know, latch their horses all to the Trump wagon, and they're going to try to take that to victory.
Well, 2 points, and one going back to something that I think we overlooked, and that is it's awfully hard to get a third term. And Cagle was trying to run as a third term of deal. And the same situation that Secretary Clinton had in trying to be the third term for President Obama. People like change, particularly after two terms. And you used the word disruptor, and I think that was a good word because Kemp has made it clear that he's going to be different than Deal. He may fulfill, may continue his policies in general, but he's going to have a different attitude. People like change, and that's what's going to make him, quite frankly, if he gets to the general, a lot more formidable camp opponent to Representative Abrams than Cagle would have been, because Cagle would have been running as a third term for Deal. It's going to be harder to pin that on Kemp. And as in terms of running to your base, you know, the fact of the matter is you got a different electorate in November than you do in the primary. Same for Republicans, same for Democrats. And whoever is the one who can actually go to the middle and run as a center-right candidate will win, because this is still a center-right state. And I would contend, based on everything that Representative Abrams has said in the past, that she's the one who intends to run to her base and stay with her base, because she's made it very clear that she's not going to follow the game plan that other Democrats have followed in the past of trying to go to the middle. She's run as a liberal Democrat. And she says that, you know, she intends to build that coalition to try to get her over 50%. I just don't think that that number of people are here in Georgia.
Well, I'm happy you brought up the point about change, because that and the people want change, because that is exactly what Stacey Abrams is. You know, we have an opportunity here to not only elect a woman in Georgia for the first time as governor, but also the first African-American. So when you're talking about change, the first person of color at all. So when we talk about change, the change is an epitome of what Stacey Abrams is and what her campaign is. And if you look not only what you were talking about what campaigns have done in the past, you're right. Stacey Abrams is inherently doing something different. She is reaching out and building a coalition of not only of African-Americans, but of all people. And her basic premise is, why are we going to keep running the same campaigns where we have not, from a Democratic Party, been successful? Well, so we're going to change that tune and reach out to all Georgians and make a difference.
Sorry, let's let Loretta get in.
Okay, so what I would say about the ad that you just ran, Brian Kemp's ad, what that does effectively, it's like a closing summary. It comes around and it wraps up. This is who I am. This is what I'm about. This is what I'm running on.
You've got to say it's a good spot for him.
Right, and this is why my opponent is not the right person. To Ed's point at the outset of this discussion, he talked about how the Cagle campaign is running negative ads at this juncture. And so coming out of those debates, the Kemp campaign, even though this was much closer of a race, you know, they were just within margin of error, the Kemp campaign made the decision to be the presumptive nominee, right? Now, to Michael's point about Stacey being change, Stacey Abrams being change, you can't be change when you have people like Cory Booker and Eric Holder coming in to represent. That's not, there's nothing centrist about
Michael.
That. Yeah. There's nothing centrist about that.
And it gets back to my point. Yes, she does represent change. She represents enormous change. The question is it the sort of change that the people of Georgia want to see in terms of the electorate, where the electorate is? And I would contend that this is still a center-right state. And Stacey has basically built her campaign and staked out her future on the fact that I could change that dynamic. I can move Georgia from a center-right state to a very left state. I just don't believe that there are enough voters out there in the state of Georgia to get her there with that kind of attitude.
If I could jump in here, what I would say is that I don't think Stacey Abrams may be as wedded to that strategy as she was last year. And if she sees an opportunity where a backlash of white frees up white suburban women to help her over that over the finish line, she goes after those, and I think she would have to. She would be more inclined to move into the center.
Do you think, Jim?
I just don't know whether or not she can, given that the amount of press she's uttered up till now, and that the Republicans are going to let her there.
But remember, this is let's talk about the context. On one side, you could have Stacey Abrams, Sarah Riggs, and McCo, Lucy McBath, and Ms. Bordeaux over in this Carolyn Bordeaux in the 6th and the 7th, okay? All right, and then you've got Donald Trump on the other side, okay? And you do realize what happened yesterday. Donald Trump just said that he was going to bring Vladimir Putin in here in September. We're gonna have a very, very nationalized gubernatorial race.
Let's not assume that you know, the entire Democratic slate and whoever that may be. It may be David Kim coming out of second, which is a whole, or out of the seventh, which is right, a whole nother right. dynamic, because then it brings the Asian Americans clear into the fold of this. So it's a very diverse, dynamic group, potential group of a slate that the Democrats could have. So, you know, the idea that, and let's not forget that Stacey Abrams had already did a spot earlier where she, the appeal was more to white males. It was a commercial, I believe. So, you know,
it wasn't terribly convincing, but
it wasn't terrible. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, I mean, but the idea is that, you know, this we're going to hunker down on this far left and just stay there. That, you know, Stacey Abrams is way too smart of a person for that, and our slate is wide enough to where it's going to capture the hearts and minds.
Well, I don't question her intelligence because I served with her for a long time, and I don't think anybody in the General Assembly ever debated her one on one in the well of the House as much as I did. But I will say this. Her history has always been hold hard to the left.
Right.
Even when she was the minority leader, she didn't really ever make any attempts to broaden the base to able to bring in new Democratic representatives.
All right. We're going to have to take a break. I think part of the record ought to be, though, as we go to the break, that one of the accusations that was leveled against Stacey Abrams frequently by the Evans campaign during the Democratic primary was her willingness to cross the aisle, cooperate with Republicans to pass legislation that wasn't as liberal as some, especially in the Black caucus, would have liked, Ed Lindsay.
Although you're talking about the Hope situation,
and
that was necessity.
All right. Yeah. I got to get a break in. We'll come back. We can finish up this conversation. Let's talk just a little bit about what the 11th Circuit Court did yesterday in reaffirming its belief that gays and lesbians do not have a right under federal law to sue for civil rights violations in the workplace. We'll be right back.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, have you taken a peek at your family tree? Carl Zimmer has, and he says that if you trace it back, you may eventually run into Cleopatra, possible ancestor of all living humans. We'll talk with him about using the math of heredity, plus how astronomers unexpectedly found 12 more moons orbiting Jupiter. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Science Friday is coming up this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Here we come, back to Political Rewind. You know, we are rapidly running out of time. I wish I could. Let me just suggest that those of you who are not watching the show on Facebook Live, go there. Go to the GPB news page. We are getting just terrific conversations started there. Too many for us to go into on the air, but it's wonderful for us to see the way you're talking about it. And, of course, these conversations continue because you can always watch the Facebook Live at any point you want to by just going to GPB news on their Facebook page. All right. So, let's go. We've got an election coming up next Tuesday. Jim Galloway, to finish up the conversation about this runoff, it is interesting that the state Republican Party has announced a unity rally that they're going to hold either the day after or 2 days after the runoff election. That's going to be an interesting event.
This is always attempted among Democrats and Republicans. Sometimes it works.
Yeah.
Sometimes it makes things worse. But it's going to be hard. Look, you know, you've got this is so interesting. And you've got Donald Trump on one side, the NRA on another side. It's not just Trump and Deal. No, there are some people who are going to have to come
together.
That's
right, because Cagle has been endorsed by the NRA.
But you know, keep in mind, I mean, you know, there was that divisive runoff campaign in 2010 between Karen Handel and Governor Deal, and there was a lot of speculation. Well, can the Republican Party ever come together after that kind of division? And they came together pretty quickly.
And the runoff was I believe in deep August.
Yes.
And so it was much later.
I recall when was it Lewis Massey, who was running against Roy Barnes in the Democratic Party? Was it the Senate race that
1998.
They were in the Senate race?
No, and, U.S.
It was the governor's race.
1998.
And Massey withdrew rather than try to challenge Barnes in a runoff election. I mean, we're not at that point. We're past the runoff by next Wednesday. But this is going to be something akin to that, one of these two having to stand up and support the other publicly, I think, right away. So we'll see how that goes. Ed Lindsay, let me start, as Jim Galloway said, I think you should start with the lawyer in the room on this one, and that's Ed Lindsay. Ed, the 11th Circuit, we've talked on this show several times about the fact that the 11th Circuit Court tends to be one of the more conservative federal courts in the United States. They've just got two new judges, Trump appointees, who will probably make it even more conservative. And just Wednesday, they ruled against a Clayton County employee named Gerald Bostic, who believed that he was who lost his job because he was revealed to be gay. The circuit court had previously looked at this, a three-judge panel, I believe, and said, no, sorry, federal law does not protect gays and lesbians against workplace discrimination. Bostic went back and asked for a full panel. The entire panel said, nope. What is the implication of that?
Well, first off, I prefer the term judicial restraint over conservative. Because I think that's what the 11th Circuit exercised here. It wasn't that they came out and said that they didn't believe, personally, that folks in the LGBTQ community deserved protection. They simply said that the bill, that the law that was passed, Civil Rights Act, simply did not include them. And this gets back to one of the issues that we have right now going on in our society as a result of some dysfunction within Congress, is that we have both the executive and the judicial sometimes trying to fill in a gap that really ought to be taken by Congress in terms of public policy. I personally think that members of the LGBTQ community do deserve protection from certain discriminatory acts. And I would like to see Congress take those steps. Quite frankly, I would like to see my state legislature take those steps. And I've advocated that in the past as well. But that's a prerogative of public policy by the legislative branch. And if we are at a point in our society in which we cannot count on our legislature to enact the necessary public policy needed for us to operate in the 21st century, we're going to be in trouble.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, that Ed took that conversation to a point I was hoping we'd get to. We know that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to be looking at this issue, and they've got different opinions from different circuits. Chicago, New York both said, yes, gays and lesbians are protected.
Right.
So, okay, but Ed made an important point. During all the conversations about religious liberty legislation at the state capitol, one of the things that the advocates who, I mean, the opponents said was, there's no protections for gays and lesbians because this state doesn't have the kind of civil rights statute that Ed Lindsay just said he thinks they should have passed.
Right, right. And if you talk to people like Jeff Graham over at Georgia Equality, what he will say is, look, you know, if you build in protections against discrimination protections for the LGBT community, then maybe we can talk RFRA.
Yeah.
Then we can talk about religious
Michael,
protections.
Michael, could Democrats go there if there is a state statute, a civil rights statute that would guarantee those protections? Would it be possible for Democrats to support a bill that mocks or imitates, rather, the same legislation that Bill Clinton passed when he was president?
I think it just gets possibly, but I think it gets to the heart of the essence, the meaning, the motive behind it, right? I mean, I think as long as this discussion about basically should, you know, the LGBT community be a protected class, I mean, that's, you know, we look at being the law of the land, and you understand these different circuits, but it gets back to the 11th, which we know is, I don't know the phrase that Ed just used, but
judicial restraint.
You know, they're becoming more conservative. We know that. We've talked about that in the past, and this is a direct result of that happening.
Well, you know, keep in mind, there was a lot of us that when RFRA was being discussed 2 and 3 years ago, this was exactly what we were advocating for. I do think a RFRA law would make sense here in Georgia, coupled with a civil rights law, because we're one of the few states that doesn't have one. And hopefully that's the sort of, if you want to call it compromise or coming together. To borrow a phrase from the Bible, come now, let us reason together. And I think that's the sort of thing that we should be looking at, because I think there are legitimate concerns on both sides of the political spectrum on this, and it's time for us to move forward and get our legislature to do so.
But, you know, that's where it's hard for us as Democrats and probably other people that don't initially affiliate as Democrats. But when you want to have a discussion around RFRA and you want to have an earnest, you want people to believe that's an earnest reasoning behind it, but yet, there's LGBT community, which we cannot get as a protected class. So it's hard to say that, you know, you can be in support of one but not the other and have an earnest feeling about
it. Let me give you the last word on this part of the conversation,
well,
Loretta.
I agree almost wholeheartedly with Ed in that, you know, it is not the role of a jurist to make law. It is the role of a jurist to interpret the law, and that our lawmakers in Washington have not
They're just not doing their job.
Yeah, they haven't stepped up in this regard. And I think at the state level, too, I agree that if this issue were addressed at a state level, you know, then we could get on to conversations that are more healthy in the future.
All right. We will watch to see if this issue plays in the gubernatorial race here in Georgia into legislative races in the fall. I'm not sure it will. We'll certainly wait to see how the Supreme Court takes this up as it looks at this very issue. So if you're listening to the show in real time, it's Friday. I wanted to close the show on a slightly lighter note today, Jim Galloway. It's been a tough week. Ted Terry, the mayor of Clarkston, made a little bit of news this week. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No,
by any
I
chance?
Don't. I don't.
Anybody know? See, I mean, this is why we on this show are so on top of everything. Ted Terry, mayor of Clarkston, Democratic mayor, youngest mayor, I think, in Georgia or whatever, was actually on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
On Netflix. He had a makeover. His house had a makeover. Ted Terry thought he needed to be a little bit more presentable and believable. Let's just listen to a moment or two from the show.
What is it like for you being a mayor? What's your biggest challenge?
I get no respect. The older council members, older just people in general will usually assume, oh, well, you know, you're young, so you don't know anything. Even though I've been like working in this arena since I was 17 years old,
yeah.
If I do all the talking, a lot of people at the table are like, why are you talking? You're young, you don't know anything.
Are you a good public speaker?
I could definitely be a lot better.
Okay.
I would love to learn.
What are you hoping to get from us?
I mean, I think I need to up my game. I need to be the best mayor I possibly can be to represent Clarkston, you know, just here in Georgia, but also internationally.
So I just wanted to give a shout out to Ted Terry. I'm not sure whether this is going to help him or hurt him.
Yeah, but you know, you might want to go with that first instinct. Maybe you don't talk so much.
For those of you who know Mayor Terry up there, he has had a mountain man beard for a long, long time. Scraggly, not terribly presentable, yet he gets elected mayor.
In Clarkston.
In Clarkston, the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy men got him to shave the beard off. If you're a Netflix subscriber, you may want to check it out. It's kind of fun to see one of the only elected officials in Georgia who would be seen caught dead, or, you know, being on a show talking about his personal image like that.
Hey, Ted's a friend of mine, and it definitely speaks to who Ted is and representing Clarkston, you know, this fantastic, super diverse city, what he does. But I'll say that, you know, the scraggly beard you talked about was Ted's resistance beard.
Yes.
And so they did kind of do away with that, but I saw Ted this last weekend,
he's
I think,
growing it
and
back,
the beard is back.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
And I might add that while I may disagree with him politically, I admire him for going on the show.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that's it. We close the show with a salute, a shout out to Ted Terry. Thank you, Loretta Lepore, Ed Lindsay, Michael Owens, Jim Bluestein.
Yeah, right.
Jim Galloway, who will be back with me on Monday for our pre-election show. Remember, next week is the beginning of our four-day-a-week schedule, Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. It was lovely to see some of you on Twitter and on Facebook saying how glad you are we're adding a day to our schedule. So if that's the case, make sure you're listening. We'll see you again on Monday. I hope you all have a great weekend.